Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are around the world. This is Len Osanek for Black Op Radio, and I'm joined in the control with my co-host, Anita Langley.
Hello, everyone. And today we have Black Op Radio number 218 for April 28th, 2005. And we are joined on the phone, we hope, by Jim Donnelly. Are you there, Jim?
Yes, I am.
Good. Okay, well, let's just have our listeners find out a little bit about our subject today. I guess we're talking about autism in general and as it relates to
vaccinations.
Now, you have a website, just so that people listening, if they want to cruise and have a listen at the same time, the website is on the World Wide Web, autism1.org. And we'll put up a link also next to this interview. So could you give us a bit of background and let us know where you're coming from here, how you got started, what got your interest in the directions that you're looking at?
Well, first it started by the fact that I have an autistic child myself. And oddly enough, when it was first suggested to me that vaccinations had anything to do with his disability, I was very resistant. In fact, I found it very difficult to believe and didn't buy it initially. But then I started looking at the logic and the science and finding some, just discovering things along the way that started pointing in the direction of convincing me. And once I saw the science, I became more and more convinced as time went on. I reviewed my son's medical records, found some correlations that made complete sense, and eventually I was completely convinced.
How old is your son?
He's 12.
And how old was he when he developed symptoms that were diagnosable?
About 2 years old.
Did you notice a regression of any sort, or did you just find he wasn't developing the way he was expected to?
We noticed regression. We didn't notice it as quickly as some people, because while he got very ill immediately after his 18-month shots, he had a new little brother that was born. And initially, we thought he was just becoming quieter and quieter in response to having a new sibling. But the fact is he eventually just quit speaking altogether and remained nonverbal till he was 6 years old.
Right. This is something we've heard often, that right after the 18-month, the two-year shots, this happens. They weren't born like this.
Right. I mean, it's clear that, the general medical community will tell you that it's genetic, it's in utero, although they have no science to back that up. That's just their theory, and a convenient one.
And on
the
opposite... The
fact is, if children were born wired wrong, they'd be wired wrong from the start. These children are perfectly normal, developing normally, and interactive and not showing any signs of autism, and then all of a sudden they regress and become nonverbal, non-social, all the things that are associated with autism all at once. There has to be something that has to trigger that change. You're not born normal and then all of a sudden change.
Yeah. Now, I can, having discussed this with my own family doctor also, and he basically said to me, well, there's been evidence of a genetic predisposition. And I said to him, well, sure, there's no reason why there can't be genetic predisposition and a trigger. And that also happened in my own family. And I had warned my brother not to get his son vaccinated. Even though there is no history of autism in my family, I specifically warned him that our children are very high risk for autism because we have autoimmune problems in our family. My mother has a history of lupus. I have fibromyalgia. My brother has a very bad case of multiple chemical sensitivity. And anybody who's looked at the research of Professor Garth Nicholson and others like him who've looked into this subject will find that there are connecting issues around these illnesses and that they are very related. And even as Professor Nicholson said to me in a private discussion, he seems to feel, and I wholeheartedly agree, that autism is the same illness only manifesting in a child where their brain hasn't developed. It's going to show a whole host of different problems, but the root cause is an autoimmune assault. And I warned my brother, don't get your child vaccinated. He didn't listen to me. He listened to his doctor, which is understandable in today's world. But unfortunately, his son is now autistic, and he has to deal with that. Needless to say, though, he doesn't get any more vaccines.
Right. Well, I mean, I found myself in his position, too. I had a very good friend who was a chiropractor who warned me adamantly, you know, Jim, don't vaccinate them. I'm telling you, don't vaccinate them. Of course, listening to MDs and general consensus and the general, you know, medical community, I thought, no, this guy is nuts. You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just radical. You know, we vaccinated him, thought we were doing the best thing, and found myself a few years ago going back to the same friend and saying, you know, Herb, you warned me. You told me not to vaccinate him, and now I wish I'd listened.
Yeah. Interestingly, with the chiropractor, too, even though I did say to my brother, you know, about the vaccines, it was actually a chiropractic friendship that his wife ended up in that actually convinced her about vaccines. It wasn't listening to me, because I guess a chiropractor is a bit closer to the medical community, and he was able to convince her, or she, I'm not sure if it was a male or female, that there was a problem there, and they started looking closer. It's very unfortunate, though, because there is so much faith put into family doctors, and the reality of the situation is that most family doctors don't even know what's in vaccines. They have no idea. And I can say this for a fact, because I showed my own family doctor one of the inserts for Pediarix, and right there it had the disclaimer about the vaccine being made in countries that are not known to have BSE, and the implication, of course, being that if it was made in a country that did have BSE, that it would be dangerous. And what about all those viruses that have not been discovered yet, that haven't been named? So we can't screen for everything that's in those vaccines. And
no.
It was an eye-opener for him, and I can tell you, just by looking at his face, he had never read the insert.
Well, most parents don't, because, you know, we're conditioned to take our doctors at their word.
Well, yeah, but this is my doctor I'm talking about. He had never read the insert. So parents don't get to see them because doctors don't give them to them, and doctors actually have to go searching to find them themselves.
Right.
Well, most doctors don't even have them on hand. If you want to know, they have to actually dig them out somewhere, look them up in a book, and chances are they aren't reading them even before they hand them off to you.
And what most people don't know is that by federal law, the doctor is supposed to provide you with a listing of the risks, so you can review them before you vaccinate your child.
Yeah.
People don't know that, and most people don't exercise that.
There is the,
knowledge.
There is the presumption of informed consent when a vaccine is given to a child. There is that presumption, and you're right, because it's on the parents to, you know, the parents have taken the responsibility, and this is one of the reasons why they can't turn around and sue, because there is this presumption of informed consent, and that was put in there, I think, pretty much to debilitate lawsuits. But it is pretty tragic that doctors themselves are so comfortable with the promotions of the drug companies that they don't bother to read these things either. And this is something I've come across.
They're not expected to, and they're not pressured to. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is these drug companies go into doctors' offices, and they say, look, you administer so many of these vaccines as well as so many of these drugs, particularly for, you know, like drugs with off-label usage, for example. And, you know, you sell X amount of this product, and we'll give you, you know, thousands of dollars in bonus, or we will give you a trip to, you know, St. Thomas or whatever. I mean, they get, you know, compensated for administering these things, and they don't question
why. And basically, that's a kickback.
Right, and you have to understand that doctors, you know, it's unfortunate. There was a time when people went into medicine because they wanted to be healers. But the fact is, and it's a sad thing to say, the majority of people who practice medicine today do it for profit, to make money, not because they care about the health and well-being of their patients. They're in business. It's as simple as that.
Now, when you're talking about medical records, is there a big upsurge, a swing of the percentage of people now getting ill after their first vaccination?
Well, that started in the late 80s, early 90s, when they started increasing the vaccine schedule. If you remember in the mid to late 80s, you know, suddenly you're seeing ADD all over the news. In the early 90s, suddenly you're seeing ADHD all over the news. In the late 90s, suddenly you're seeing autism all over the news. You know, and these things these disorders came out of nowhere. And they said that, well, these things have existed all along. Well, where were they? you see people who have vaccines, you know, and even today, you'll talk to a lot of parents who say, yeah, you know, I gave them shots, and they got sick, but I'd rather just give them, you know, the 6, 7, 8 shots and get it done and over with all at once. Let them be sick for a few days, and I've got it done, and I can get back to work and living life as normal. And, you know, there are a lot of people, children, who end up getting sick after their shots and eventually lucking out and getting back to at least some state of normalcy, you know, define normal. But as far as, you know, medical records or being able to track that, there really isn't much tracking of that. And what information there is that tracks reactions to vaccines is actually kept top secret at the FDA and CDC.
Yeah, actually, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. But on that subject, there is a very narrow window where people can report adverse vaccine reactions. But isn't it interesting, though, that incubation periods for a lot of illnesses can go in, you know, in the weeks, whereas the reactions have to be reported pretty much within 48 hours.
Right. If it's not immediate, then it's hard to justify that it was actually the vaccine. I mean, there are numerous cases of SIDS, for example, where parents are facing jail time and being accused of shaking their baby, shaken baby syndrome, SIDS, things like that.
Right.
And a lot of these children, if you were actually to go back and check their history, they'd been vaccinated within a few days of dying from these disabilities.
Because also there's often a case of swelling in the brainstem associated with the vaccines, and that is the same type of thing that is found in the case of shaken babies. So,
right. It's very similar. In fact, you know, they'll identify, you know, inflammation of the glial cells, which is a common symptom of mercury poisoning. And then again, you know, the component in vaccines that is of the greatest concern at this time is thimerosal, which again is 50% mercury.
Now, that's an interesting subject in itself because, you know, so many of the vaccine manufacturers are right now claiming that the mercury has, that they're not using the mercury or there's no mercury in their vaccines anymore, when in fact, most of the vaccines are still being made with mercury, but the mercury is being dropped out after the effect until it's below a threshold. Now, anybody who's really familiar with science on the level of the big-time chemistry and isotopes, they know that, you know, mercury, it's possible for it to take on non-metallic form, and I don't know that they can guarantee that they're actually getting all the mercury out, because if you have isotopes or anything like that that's not being detected by their assay, it's not being burned off, we don't really know how much mercury is in those vaccines, because the fact is they're using mercury to start with, and they're presuming they're taking it all out because their equipment says no more of this type of mercury is left in there. Well, I know from other types of metals and research in those degrees in, for other reasons that you can have different types of gold, you can have different types of silver. It's not all metallic just because it's gold. It's not all metallic just because it's silver. And from what I'm seeing, there is an acknowledgement of the different types of mercury. So we're presuming an awful lot, and there's an awful lot on faith being taken here. Because to my knowledge, still in the mining industry, when an assay is done for gold, they're just looking for metallic gold. So our science is not yet nearly evolved well enough to make the kind of presumption that is being made when you put mercury in something, mix it around a little bit, and then say you're taking it all out. I'm sorry, I don't buy it.
Right, and then on top of that, there's a lot of misinformation that is produced by the manufacturers using these products given to the media. You know, there's a lot of assumptions, presumptions made based on what the media releases. But the fact is, you know, the perfect example is the Pediarix vaccine that you mentioned. You know, they say, well, we make it and then we take it back out. Well, you really don't know that. They say, well, we guarantee that we'll only have X amount.
Yeah, less than 25.
Vaccine, yeah. Which is 25
nanograms. Yeah, they say less than 25 nanograms. But, you know, as we're saying, I mean, we're presuming that they're able to detect the mercury in the various forms. Mercury can form compounds that might not come apart the way they expect them to. We just don't know. And, I can't trust that.
Mercury is light sensitive, and it breaks apart, you know, if it's exposed to light, for example. No telling, and there's not enough knowledge about what else it does to it. I mean, you know, but even that amount that they say we guarantee it won't go above that, and they downplay it and say it's a minute amount, yet that amount is still 11 times the EPA safety margin.
Right.
Okay. And this is the thing. This particular vaccine, which was added to the vaccine schedule to increase the number of shots to get, this vaccine made with Samaracel came out 5 days after controversial legislation was entered into the Homeland Security Bill, giving drug makers immunity from prosecution from litigation over use of this product.
Yeah, I've got to love how that works.
Oh, well, you know, you got to remember that we've got a Senate Majority Leader who has a huge, huge financial interest in the healthcare industry. That's how he attained his wealth. And, you know, he knows which hands feed him. And then you've got a president whose father sits on the board of the company that has the patent on this product of Samaracel, this mercury additive that's added to the vaccines. And they've got very good friends that they've appointed to their cabinets and to the Homeland Security Commission who were either previously employed of this company or sitting at the in the CEO's chair at this time. I mean, the conflict of interest is so huge, it's unbelievable. And the thing is this is information that's not made readily available to the public.
Well, it used to be that autism was considered an extremely rare disease and that it would afflict less than 1 in 10,000 children. That is a, you know, very low risk. But we look around now, and I can think off the top of my head of at least half a dozen people that I know with immediate family members who got children who are autistic, and that's, you know, within a very close circle. That's not talking about people such as yourself who have gone out and interviewed and friends of friends that I'm hearing through the grapevine. That's people who've said, you know, this has caused some sort of injury. There's something that's not right here. The numbers are so high right now that it is my understanding that in some areas incidence of autism are something like 1,600% above the norm, and that's
actually a little closer to 4,000.
Yeah, as a matter, I was just about to say, and that statistics that actually came from about 4 to 5 years ago. So I can only imagine as these things have become even more prominent.
So thousands of percent higher.
Yeah,
thousands.
Yeah, so that's amazing. That takes us down to, in some cases, we're looking at more than one out of every 200 in certain areas of England, for example, with autistic boys, where boys being seeming to be, for some reason, a bit more susceptible.
Well, right. And the thing is in the United States, it's one in every 166 children. But when you consider that it affects four times as many boys as girls, you got to think that, well, that's actually coming out to a much more severe number for the boys. I don't know exactly what that number is, but I would guess it's more like one in every 80 to 100 boys.
Yeah.
Although that is a guess. We know that you're still looking at a 1% to 2% of our, you know, children's population being affected by this disability.
Yeah, that's a tremendous number. That's a tremendous number when you think about how rare autism once was.
Right. And say, well, diagnoses, you know, is better because people are more aware. Well, you know, the reason people are more aware is because there's more of the children now. I mean, you got to remember,
exactly,
the first cases of autism were identified by Leo Kanner in 1943, which is only about 3 years after the first vaccines were administered.
Yeah, now that's a very important point, I think. And it is a very new disease in our direct human memory. The early literature doesn't really have a lot. I mean, I suppose that it's possible that there, you know, were cases of it here and there. There have been, for whatever reasons, been poisonings over the years, and various people are going to be exposed to stuff. But in an actual epidemic proportion, one would say that it's been going on in the last 50 years anyways. Then that's a pretty tremendous increase in numbers.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is the number, the rate of autism is run in perfect correlation to the increase in Samaracel-containing vaccines for a consistent history of 72 years now, with almost no deviation on the bar chart.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, there's a telltale sign by itself.
And, of course, that's just the Marisol that we're talking about. That's a very serious one, but there are actually some other very serious problems with vaccines as well, and I think we shouldn't overlook aluminum, because aluminum is used, and here's the medical term that we use for it, it's an adjuvant, which means it assists in getting the immune system fired up. Now, that's a very kosher, nice way to say that it aggravates the immune system so that the immune system goes looking for whatever's causing trouble. And that is why the immune system is able to find, hopefully, that which we want it to find when somebody receives an inoculation. But well, what's getting it going is this aluminum in the first place, and there's no way to flush it out of the body.
Right. And the thing is it was actually doing research on the aluminum is how we stumbled onto the mercury link. And the thing is this isn't discounting any other additives. I mean, believe me, vaccines have aluminum. They have, you know, monkey viruses. They have, you know, a component that's the same chemical structure as antifreeze in them. And there are a lot of components to vaccines to be concerned about. The thing is Dr. Boyd Haley did a study comparing aluminum, mercury, antibiotics, and hormones and things like that to find out how their toxicity affected brain neurons. And the thing he found out is that aluminum increased the toxicity of the mercury, you know, multitudes of times. The thing is the mercury, he also compared, you know, antibiotics to the aluminum by itself, then he did antibiotics to the mercury, and the most profound component that caused the most brain neuron death was mercury.
Right.
And that's not discounting the other things, but that is why, that study alone was why we found mercury to be the cause for the greatest alarm. Now, in this same study, another telltale sign is he also compared these components to testosterone and estrogen to see how they might affect cell neuron death. And the fact is the most potent and toxic combination that he found was mercury and testosterone. You combine the two together, you have 100% brain neuron death within 3 hours. Tells us why it affects four times as many boys as girls.
Exactly. Now, you brought up an important point about the mercury being accented in a way by the aluminum, and this is actually something that isn't probably very well known, but, yeah, very much worth bringing up, that there's something about, there's a symbiotic relationship between these chemicals, and when you put them together, you have a huge multiplying effect of the damage being done. And one can only guess as to how much damage is being done in addition from the aluminum on its own. But yes, when you put the two together, very bad news indeed.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is we're not saying that the mercury is the only cause. It's just right at this time with the research that we do have, that is the component that is of the greatest concern. What other factors that are contributing to this thing are things that still need yet to be discovered, and they're issues that are for continuing debate.
Now, on an individual basis, for the harm done to the individual by a vaccine, I have to wholeheartedly agree with you as far as the mercury from what I can see. But I do have a much larger concern also on a genetic scale for the whole human race, because if we're injecting animal viruses, all it takes is for one person to mutate one of those viruses, and we have a pandemic that cannot be controlled at all. And we've seen susceptibility with avian flus and with the swine flus, and there is absolutely no reason to think that we're safe from administering to ourselves a fatal concoction, something that the human race just cannot bounce back from. And that has me more than just a little worried.
Well, I have a question kind of reflecting to that. What do you think that the success rate of taking the vaccine is in the first case, then, in preventing diseases, is that up? Is that a fact?
Well, the CDC and the FDA will swear up and down that that's the case. But the fact of the matter is every disease and disorder that they have a vaccine for was on the decline prior to the introduction of these vaccines. So to say that these vaccines ended these epidemics is an out-and-out lie. The fact is, smallpox, diphtheria, all of those were well on the decline before the vaccines were entered. I mean, the reason that, you know, these things were on the decline is because people are now living in cleaner and more sanitary living conditions. They're not exposed to these things as much.
Also, plus the human species itself will develop over time as generations go through these illnesses, will develop resistance. There's probably a lot of bugs that we are resistant to today that would have wiped us out 200, 300 years ago, and furthermore, bugs from farther back that we've lost resistance to. So these things are an ongoing situation, and to think that we can just immunize ourselves against all the bugs. Well, also that makes our immune systems lazy too, and we have to look at the repercussions of that sort of thing. But I think there's probably plenty of real evidence about in certain situations where vaccines have helped in because they are in essence homeopathic, and their concept is not that far from in essence from an allergy type of medication, where a small dose of something is given to somebody so they can fight back. The problem is when you're working with a living organism, or one that's been attenuated, killed off, and all these different additives are being added, you've moved away too far from the homeopathic principles to really be calling it the same thing anymore. But in essence, that which the idea is founded on, it's not really a bad idea. It's how it's being used and profited from. And I go back again to Professor Nicholson, who reiterated that he's actually pro-vaccine. He just wants to see it done right.
Well, I want to be very clear. Autism One and I am not an anti-vaccine organization. And, you know, I'm all for protecting children anyway, and everybody any way that we can. But you have to remember, the people that produce these vaccines, it is based on a homeopathic principle, but these are the same people who will tell you that homeopathic remedies do not work.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's almost like saying, you can't rely on a plant, even though all our drugs that we do research on are plant-based. And it's funny, it's very hypocritical in a lot of senses, but still... vaccine companies, their bottom line is the dollars, and if they're going to make vaccines safely, they're going to be out of the price range of people to be able to buy them, and it's not going to be profitable, and nobody's going to make big money for selling their mercury-based products. So I think there are too many conflicts of interest, and it runs all through the FDA. It doesn't help when you have people of power being brought on the board of directors for some of these, you know, powerful companies, and between the lobbyists from the companies and the actual promises being made to politicians when they retire, it's pretty hard to get around all this stuff. I mean, the U.S. government did actually sponsor some major research into there was a House committee that investigated conflicts of interest in vaccine manufacturers, and they found horrible conflicts of interest. But that doesn't mean anything's being done about it, because the same people who are responsible for cleaning up the mess are profiting from it.
Absolutely. It's like having the fox watch the hen house. And, you have these people, I mean, and a lot of people that work for these government agencies eventually go to work for these drug companies. And a lot of their employees, you know, at one point probably, you know, it was funded by these drug companies to do a project in school, or came from the drug company and went to work for them in a managerial position. And so they only see one side of the story. And the bias is unbelievable. I mean, you know, they've been presented with, I mean, compelling evidence, yet they'll respond with, well, we weren't satisfied that really told us anything. Well, they weren't satisfied because they didn't like what they heard.
Sorry, I didn't mean, if you had some more to say. Have you found many parents object to your position on vaccines if they have an autistic child themselves, or do you find that most parents that you are aware of that are dealing with autism pretty much know where it came from?
Well, bear in mind that I live in Indianapolis, which is the world headquarters for Eli Lilly, who again sells these vaccines and holds the patent for the thimerosal that's used in them. And so from within Indianapolis and in the state of Indiana, those who have a financial interest in Indianapolis really resist me wholeheartedly. I mean, they are not interested in hearing what I say, and I've been met with resistance on numerous occasions. But outside of that state, where people have a financial interest there, I have found that probably 60-70% of parents with an autistic child will tell you that they believe the vaccines had something to do with it. Many of the others aren't sure of whether they did or they didn't. Some said they believed that something had... they believe something was wrong before the child was born. And, you know, whether that was paranoia or, you know, emotional or some other sign. I don't know what that is, so I couldn't give you, you know, an accurate assessment of that by any stretch of the imagination, nor would I pretend to. But most parents believe so. They've seen the correlation. They've seen these children, you know, develop normally to a point and then all of a sudden lose them. And the parents who have experienced that, which is the majority, you know, will tell you that I didn't believe it at first, but I believe it now because it makes sense. I've seen the science. I've seen what happened to my child, and I can't believe that they were born that way and suddenly changed.
Right. Well, in some cases, now, we also have evidence of mycoplasmas being transmitted through vaccines, and they can come with a whole host of autoimmune batteries because they are actually microorganisms and can reproduce and cause infections among families, which has been found to be a large part of the Gulf War syndromes. A lot of people who went over there got sick. Some of them got the vaccines and didn't even go over there, and they got sick, passed it on to their families, their pets, and whatnot. So it is conceivable that that problems can develop in people and not actually be as a result of the vaccine anymore because the contaminants are already in the parents to some degree.
Well, bear in mind that one little tidbit about the Gulf War syndrome was that the French had zero cases of Gulf War syndrome, and they fought there just like everybody else. And the French were also the only military who refused the American vaccines.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point.
So, you know, the thing is it's very likely that the vaccines had something to do with Gulf War syndrome. And what pathway was involved with that, how that came to be, I couldn't begin to tell you. My guess is that's top secret information sitting still in Washington, D.C. somewhere, not for release.
A lot of the people who've had children, victims of Gulf War syndrome, have had autistic children as well. And it is presumably because of the illness that they themselves received from the vaccines. So this can, in fact, be passed on. And this was actually the root of the reason that I had discussed with Professor Nicholson the connections between many of these autoimmune diseases and autism, and the childhood manifestation being actually an autism-type illness, because he had seen himself so many of these parents who have fibromyalgia, who have the multiple chemical sensitivity, having children who are then autistic, if not a whole host of other problems on top. So I think that there's ample proof in there. And, of course, I would have to think that you're quite right. The U.S. military does not want to make a big issue out of that because they've got wars to fight, and they don't need people refusing vaccines or anything else as part of their duty. And it is it is extremely unfortunate because here these people go to war, they go in service of their country, and they come home, they're sick, and they're told it's in their head, that it's their imaginations, that they're just being lazy, that, basically no support. And they pretty much had to have the support forced out of them. And I think there's barely a recognition now that Gulf War syndrome is an actual disease and not something that's in people's heads. But we're still a long ways from ever having that properly addressed. I still think it comes down to the connections, though, between vaccines, and you very astutely mentioned the French connection there, because it seems to be just too much of a coincidence, something like that.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is autoimmune disorders are, you know, manifest. I mean, many, many, many persons with autism have some sort of autoimmune disorder. I mean, numerous children have been tested, and they found, you know, strains of measles virus in the cerebral spinal fluid. And that measles virus has been, identified as the exact same strain that is used in the MMR vaccine that's administered to these children in the U.S. and England today. It just happened to be the exact same strain with the, you know, whatever code, DNA structure, whatever, that could have, you know, varied thousands of times, you know, got there, without it coming from the vaccine, I have no idea. Did, you know, did the Samaricel cause a susceptibility to cause the measles to get there, or was there something in the measles virus that created this susceptibility to the Samaricel? Nobody knows. There's not enough research on it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a big presumption for us to think that we can administer a living organism and have everybody respond the same way. Because as we know, you know, a room full of people can be exposed to a flu or a cold, and some people will get sick, some people won't. Some people will get very sick, and some people who are weak might die. Now, in a case of something like that, it really does depend, I think, a lot on the individual immune systems, genetic susceptibility, and perhaps if there is the existence or the presence of another aggravating factor, such as the mercury compound or the aluminum or who knows, any host of things. But when we're administering, and in many cases these things are cocktails of bugs, not just the contaminants, but the actual bugs that we're trying to make somebody resistant to, it's a big assault on the immune system to all of a sudden have that stuff administered, a small child especially.
Right, and, especially and, a small child who has a developing immune system, not even a completely developed immune system. I mean, bear in mind, they start giving these children these shots with the mercury, with the other contaminants, you know, the day that they're born, and give them numerous shots prior to their being 6 months old. And the important factor is that until a child is 6 months old, they don't have the renal or the biliary capacity to tolerate these contaminants.
Yeah.
They don't have a voice. They can't speak for themselves.
Yeah.
And the parents are sold on the idea that these things are going to make them better, and when indeed they actually compromise the child.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to end up in the future looking back on the last century, and just the future historians are just going to wonder just how crazy our money lust got, that we could turn around and do this to our children without even questioning. In this day and age, we should be a little bit more concerned about the honesty of these companies, when we know over and over again we're seeing the public scammed, and you know, anything from Enron to, well, I mean, FDA corruption is manifest, and we've had persons on this program thinking specifically of Arthur Evangelist, who is he was an FDA inspector and caught his boss falsifying reports. You know, when you live in a world where money is so important and all you have to do is buy a favor to get something approved, we have to be really careful when that something approved is going to be bypassing our immune systems and going directly into the body. And I think with vaccines, that's more of a problem than just with a lot of the other things that we get exposed to, because we are bypassing our digestive systems.
Oh, yeah, you're bypassing all the body's defense mechanisms. I mean, you're bypassing the digestive system. You're bypassing, the liver, the kidneys, all these things going directly into the bloodstream, which means, you know, which keeps the body from fighting it off. And the thing is you're introducing these things into these children. I mean, and you don't know. Most people don't know what's in these things. I mean, I found out a year ago that some of the polio vaccines, for example, had the SV40 virus that was in there, which used in the manufacture of the vaccine. What people don't know is that particular virus that's used in that manufacture is actually the monkey form of AIDS. And they're injecting this thing into our children. So, yeah, we're going to protect them from polio.
Well, now they say they can screen for SV40, but of course I ask, you know, they know they're using monkey kidneys and whatnot to grow a lot of these things, and that includes this Pediarix, by the way. What presumption is it that we've got all these viruses figured out? How many millions, if not billions, of different viruses are there on the planet? And they got up to SV40, and how many after that?
I have no idea, but it's almost comical. I mean, if you think about all these new vaccines they're trying to introduce now, I mean, do you remember SARS?
Oh, yeah.
They don't even know what it is, what caused it. They can't even identify the virus, but they had a vaccine for it.
I know, and that's ridiculous.
How can you develop a vaccine for a disease that you don't even know, that you can't even identify?
And also something that has the ability to mutate so quickly. In Vancouver, that's a sore spot here, because we had a serious case of SARS here, and we had also and this wasn't very well advertised, that we had an outbreak in an old folks' home that they couldn't trace it. And they know it was SARS, but it was a weaker strain. So the whole thing was pretty much buried. And meanwhile, this weaker strain, as far as I'm concerned, has done its rounds around Vancouver. Myself and quite a few people that I know of have had pneumonia, and it wasn't just a regular pneumonia. I've had pneumonia when I was a kid. I know the difference. The next day, I got a fever. The next day, I could hardly breathe. I was in so much grief from my chest. And to this day, I still have problems from that, and I've developed asthma that was never a problem for me. So, I mean, speaking for myself, I think the SARS thing, I'm really ticked off about it, but if anything, I suppose I am glad that it has at least raised some awareness as to how quickly these things could travel. And hopefully, if there is a really bad outbreak somewhere, people will be a little more on the ball. Because this one, I'm telling you, they dropped the ball big time. They did in Vancouver, and they probably did in other places too. We're just damn lucky that it wasn't a far more virulent strain that that got loose around here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it could have been much worse. I mean, it could have been me, but I'm just kidding. But you're right. I mean, but yet getting back to the vaccine, yet, you know, they try to sell these things, and they're selling things that they don't know enough about. If they come up with a product that could be marketed, that could show profit, you know, that's what they do. I mean, rotavirus, for example. I mean, how many children did that hurt, you know, when they came out with that vaccine? You know, the RotaShield, yet the person who had the patent on that particular vaccine swore up and down that it was safe, sold the FDA on it. The FDA, it's safe. FDA said it's safe because he said so. And then, you know, numerous children, I mean, some, I think 8 children died, for example. And yet this is the same person who stands up today and says, yeah, the vaccines are safe, the vaccines do not cause autism. And how many children has he killed already?
You know what, though? You hear the same argument all the time when somebody quotes that children have died from these, and they say, well, look how many people died from polio. That's really the typical comeback that I hear coming from medical professionals. So many people were dying from polio. And, yeah, but that doesn't mean it's okay to let people die from vaccines, especially when it's preventable.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I was very insulted by a doctor in Indianapolis again, who said, well, you know, the benefit outweighs the risk. You know, I thank that doctor for acknowledging that there is a risk with the vaccines. But I said, explain that benefit to my vaccine-injured child. The one that has to spend the rest of his life living with what that vaccine did to him. Okay? It was of no benefit to him. And yet, you know, they just look at it. You know, our population is, they call it herd immunity, and that's what we are. We're just a herd of bodies, dump these things into and collect lots of dollars from. And, you know, and it's sad that our society has become that way. And anybody that can look for an excuse to bypass these topics, you know, they'll jump on the bad wagon. And the thing is these are the people that the media generally will talk to, and they won't talk to those of us who know what's really going on.
Yeah. Yeah, a common reaction from parents is, it's too stressful. I can't look at that. I mean, I've heard that myself. I remember passing a tape to somebody in my family to listen to, because who had a newborn child, and she couldn't because it was too stressful to think about. And my thought was, well, you better damn well hope that you don't end up with some real stress in your life then, because, you know, you want to play Russian roulette that way.
Yeah,
I didn't want to hear it either when it was first suggested. I mean, you know, I wanted to discount. I didn't want to believe that I had a role in causing my child's autism. And you know, eventually you have to face fact. I mean, you know, people don't want to hear that. I mean, for one example, we went to the CDC, and we showed them a study where they administered these products to mice with the thimerosal to see, and they were toe-walking, they were regressing, they were getting off in their own world, they weren't socializing, they were showing all the signs of autism. And they did the same thing with pigs. And we showed this information to Julie Gerberding, who is the director of the CDC. And what she did was she turned around in her chair, faced away from the film, and covered her eyes with her hands. She wouldn't look at it. You know, which was, A, was an insult, but B, she just, you know,
yeah.
See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. You know, and it was just, you know, people don't want to accept the fact that these things are risky and that there is a clear and present danger.
Now, your work with Autism One, right. I'm guessing it's not just about vaccines, because from looking at your webpage, I didn't see vaccines screamed all over it.
Right. Well, again, and I'll stress, we are not an anti-vaccine group. We're not an anti-mercury group or anything like that. We're about hope and the fact that our children can and do get better. The general medical community has failed these children miserably. Not only have they created cases of autism, but they have failed them in treating them. And the thing is we've tried to bring together some of the best minds about that know about how to treat these children effectively and how to help them. And a lot of the methodologies that are used in treating these children aren't generally accepted practices. And one of the reasons I believe that they aren't generally accepted practices is because to treat them for the mercury damage and for the autoimmune disorders is to admit that the vaccines had a role in it. And
yeah.
Doctors generally don't want to have any part of that. But we're not just about, you know, biomedical. We're not just about, you know, Marisol, we're also about education, we're about family issues, we're about legal issues, we're about educating parents on what they can do for their child. Bear in mind that autism is a spectrum disorder. It has a spectrum of causal effects, it has a spectrum of symptoms, it has a spectrum of effects, as well as a spectrum of severity for each individual. And the thing is because of that, there are a spectrum of options available to parents. And parents have to discover what's the best route for their child. And all of these things vary from one child to the other. No two autistic children or persons with autism are exactly alike. And so the options that need to be made available to them have to vary and be customized for each individual. And so what we do is we have 110 speakers at our conference. We bring them together so parents can be exposed to a lot of this information and then decide what paths may be right. Might be best for them and for their family and for their children. And it's not just about the children, it's about the adults with autism. It's also about the families and the people who are affected by this disability. It's also about the people who teach them, the educators, the professionals, and it's also about making information available to the doctors and to people who can treat them so they can find out what it is they can do.
Now, have you had anybody speaking about tetracycline?
No, we have not. You know, we do have some mention of the antibiotics' effect on the autoimmune system, as well as how much they affected the vaccine reaction to the children. And again, you know, they're a part of other people's presentations. However, it has not been a focus of a single presentation.
The reason I bring it up actually is sort of a roundabout thing, but it's one of the things that Professor Nicholson had mentioned, that they found considerable improvement with autism and actually had some kids pulled out of it with long-term tetracycline treatment, which basically would treat the autoimmune problems. Now, there might be, whether it's that the mercury has allowed some of these to develop, or whether in these particular cases it's actually some of the other types of infections that are causing the autism and not the mercury, I couldn't say one way or another. But it's interesting to note, for my own personal little ditty here, I'll let people know, like I have mentioned, I've had a problem with autism, which has all, or not autism in my family, but my own personal problem with fibromyalgia. I've also had a serious Crohn's-like disease, which developed after my pregnancy from this very, very actually bad, and I was pretty much needing surgery in a bad way. And I started taking a plant called cat's claw, which also has the tetracycline compounds, and I can't even begin to tell you how that turned me around. And just to let people know that we're talking about something that's a serious antiviral on top of quite a few other things, I was developing clusters of warts on my foot at the time I started taking this, and it killed all my warts off. My doctor was just shocked. I showed him where one of them had hemorrhaged and died. He'd never seen anything like that. But just to throw that out there for anybody who wants to, you know, give something like that a run, because it's basically saved me from debilitating surgery. And I'm seriously considering trying to figure out a way to create alter it so that it can be administered, let my brother try it for his multiple chemical sensitivity, and if it works for him, you never know, maybe for his son as well. The point being that if it's fixing my fibromyalgia problems and these things are somehow related, it might have some benefit to some of the other people who are experiencing these types of illnesses. So it's worth keeping in mind, and I found it quite interesting to note when I was reading the list of ingredients in there that tetracycline is one of the natural things that this plant produces.
Well, I don't know enough about it to really comment on the tetracycline itself. I do know that there has been some schools of thought that, you know, antibiotics might actually compromise the autistic children's abilities as well. There again, you know, that varies from body to body because, again, each one of their symptoms are different. We do know that the antibiotics, you know, can increase the toxicity of the mercury that's used in vaccines. My son's case, I actually think the antibiotics, it wasn't tetracycline, actually compounded the effects on him and actually finished the job, causing him to go over the edge into autism. So because he was very ill, he got very ill after he had his vaccines. We took him to the doctor a week later because he wasn't getting any better, and the doctor immediately treated him with antibiotics, and that compromised what immune system he had left. And now he has numerous digestive disorders and candida yeast and constipation and things, you know, of that nature as a result of that, because it blew away what good natural intestinal flora that he had remaining that was his body was using to fight off the vaccine.
That is actually really important to bring up, too, because whenever you're messing with antibiotics, you're disrupting the intestinal flora. And I think it's important for people, and I don't think doctors, emphasize this enough, for people to take something like Acidophilus bifidus if they have to take an antibiotic. I would hope that something like, for example, the plant that I'm mentioning, being a natural plant, I don't think it does the same kind of, because it has had some research done, it hasn't got the same kind of disruptive effects. But at the same time, it is important, yeah, to pay attention to stuff like that. And your son was so sick at the time that the antibiotics were being administered, he probably had a whole lot of stuff going on there. But, of course, anything like that has to be very well researched. I really have to recommend looking into Professor Nicholson's work in that regard, because he's done quite a bit. But that being said... important to note. So you really think that when they tried to treat him with antibiotics, it just made things a lot worse?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is he was having a reaction to his vaccines, which had numerous viruses in them. This was, you know, right after he had 7 shots on his, you know, when he was 18 months old. I mean, it was that, you know, that week. And the thing is how do you treat body being compromised by viruses with an antibiotic? Because antibiotics will not have any effect on viruses.
No, it sounds like actually a bit of a different situation. In the case of tetracycline, though, I think it's got more of a far-reaching effect, and it's very specific. I mean, Professor Nicholson was very specific about this is tetracycline and not other antibiotics. So there's probably something specific about this one individual that acts a little bit differently.
Right. Well, I'm not qualified to really comment.
No, neither am I. But I do remember grilling him on that, and he is qualified. I do remember grilling him on that, and he was quite specific that we're talking about tetracycline and not some other. You can't just throw in whatever into the cocktail. But anyways, I still think that there has to be a lot more research done on that. But for my own anecdote, I would still like to throw that out there about the cat's claw, because. I can't even begin to tell you the difference it's made for me, and obviously what I'm experiencing is an autoimmune problem also. But at the same time, not to be overconfident on any regard, this is a new territory we're entering into, and as you've mentioned, with everybody, it is a very unique disease with its own manifestations.
Well, absolutely, and the thing is there is still a lot of research that needs to be done. You know, to say that vaccines definitely cause the autism is really jumping the gun a bit, because there are other factors, and who knows what those factors could be. I mean, you know, you've also got, you know, the increased use of personal computers and cell phones that, you know, skyrocketed about the same time that autism started skyrocketing. You've got more and more women who are having their children later in life because, you know, they've got careers to get together first, or... You know, people are just waiting because they want to get the life together first. And then, I don't know. You've got the increased use of fertility drugs. You know, could that be a factor? Nobody knows yet.
But I think that these cocktails, though, that they're mixing together more and more vaccines at one time.
Oh, absolutely.
Really exponentially.
I mean, the thing is, they came out with the Pediarix vaccine, and it's got five vaccines in one shot. You know, I mean, that's a pretty significant cocktail. And, you know, bear in mind, they're giving this shot to children at 2, 4, and 6 months old. And, you know, the majority of this is given to them before they have the liver or the kidney capacity to tolerate them.
Yeah. You know, I find interesting also is that this argument, I'm topping this one off the top of my head because a very qualified medical professional was quite irritated at the suggestion that mercury could get into the bloodstream as a result of a vaccine, because after all, they pull back the plunger, and if it's, you know, as anybody knows, if you pull back the plunger, you're supposed to get a little bit of blood in there if you hit a blood vessel. Well, as somebody, I used to work in hospital lab services for a living for almost 5 years. I was one of those vampire types, and I can tell you for a fact that you can sever, disrupt, or whatever, any number of capillaries and never know it when you're punctured. And the way that a doctor or a needle or a nurse pulls back the plunger on a needle would collapse any small vein. So to suggest that it can't get into the bloodstream through injecting it or into the fatty tissue. And also, because let's look at it, if they're putting aluminum in there as an adjuvant, then they're presuming that it's getting into the bloodstream in order to do its job. So if the aluminum can get into the bloodstream, so can the mercury.
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, if you can get anything else out of that shot, if you can get the rest of the shot into the bloodstream, then the mercury would go with it because the body has no mechanism by which it can separate the mercury from the rest of the shot.
But this is the type of logic that I'm hearing coming from supposedly educated medical professionals.
Well,
and it has absolutely no bearing in reality whatsoever.
Well, in reality, they're just grasping at straws is what they're doing. A perfect example. I mean, there was a doctor in Indianapolis. As soon as they came out with a study that said, guess what? You know, children with autism have enlarged brains. He immediately went to the public media and said, this proves that mercury has nothing to do with autism. These children have enlarged brains. Well, guess what? That's, if you read the study, you would see that the study identified that the enlargement they found in the brains was that of the glial cells in the brain. Well, what happens when mercury enters the brain? It enlarges the glial cells. So guess what? It proved us more right. But the doctor jumped the gun, and he either A, knows nothing about mercury toxicity, or B, was out and out lying, which would be what I would be more inclined to believe. And it's just really stupid logic, you know, to say, well, okay, they have enlarged brains, so that proves it's not mercury.
It's interesting to note that it has been found that many autistic children actually don't excrete mercury properly. It is trapped in the hair follicles, and the elevated mercury in the hair follicles actually suggests that there is some sort of genetic inability to handle the heavy metals that perhaps makes certain children more susceptible.
Well, yeah. In fact, you know, I mean, that is, again, another study that was done by Boyd Haley and Mark Blaxall and Amy Holmes as well, where they studied the birth hair of these children, and the autistic's mean level of mercury levels in their hair, the mercury levels were actually much lower in the autistic's as far as the hair was concerned, than it was in children that we would consider normal.
Basically, because the body couldn't excrete it into the hair follicle.
It showed that the body was not excreting it. So, I mean, you know, that was demonstrated. And, you know, it is a genetic susceptibility. We believe that to be the case. What's causing that genetic susceptibility, exactly what it is, what other factors can be contributing to that, we still have yet to find out. But that was clearly a telltale sign.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that, to the best of my knowledge, that research has been duplicated, although I couldn't tell you who it was that duplicated it.
Yeah, I'm not aware, but some very, very solid research in the first place, and I believe Lancet published that, so we're not talking about bubblegum wrappers and, you know, internet moms scribbling paranoia.
Oh, no, this was a peer-reviewed study that was, it was in the American Journal of, I think it was the American Journal of Toxicology, that's where that showed up. That was a peer-reviewed study. I mean, you know, and people that did this, I mean, these were PhDs at well-known universities. These are definitely bona fide studies.
Yeah.
Yeah, to show this kind of information.
Now, we've had you here for an hour, and before we wrap up, I'd just like to know if there's anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to go over.
Well, I'd like really just talk a little bit more about the Autism One conference.
Okay.
We're going to have a lot of the experts who have done this research that we have discussed tonight attending this conference and doing presentations. Anybody who is interested in seeing the research or discussing it with them or hearing about it is welcome to come to the conference. A lot of these people did presentations last year, and their PowerPoint presentations as well as abstracts of their presentations are available on the website, so they can go to them and download them and review them. Although it's not the same thing as getting the whole story, you can at least look at some of the documentation that they made available to the attendees. Not only that, but if you do have someone who, you know, if you do have autism affecting your life somehow, or you know someone who is living with autism some way, even if it's a teacher, you know, a doctor, uncle, aunt, nephew, brother, sister, mom, dad, or the person who's dealing with autism themselves, you know, there is a wide range of information that's made available there. And, you know, and we deal with family issues, legal issues, how do I advocate for myself, what do I do as an adult when I get to get into the workplace to advocate for myself in order to make sure that I'm treated fairly, in order to get my needs met without calling attention to myself. I'm a sibling. I deal with this with my brother. I don't know what to do. There's going to be people there talking to them, the importance of dads. You know, there's family issues, as well as people who have to deal with the school systems, which is a broad topic all by itself. You know, how do I get the education services that I need? How do I get them what they need and make sure that I get the proper educational treatments and find out what's best for my child? How do I avoid due process? As well as what's going on in government. What are we doing to advocate in government? What are the next steps? Where are we now with Washington? You know, that's kind of information that we make available. We have 110 speakers. We have people that are going to discuss dietary issues, biomedical issues, what kind of treatments are available, what can the diet do for me, is it right, you know, is this type of treatment right for me, as well as a lot of networking interfacing. You know, there are going to be a lot of parents there who are new, looking for answers. I've just received a diagnosis. Where do I go from here? And we're going to have parents who are mentors who have been through this and fought this battle for years, and they're going to be available to talk to the new parents and so they can share their experiences. This is what you might try. This might be something you can do. This is where you can go to get this kind of information. This is where you can go to get this kind of service. You know, so the thing is we've made it very wide, made the information widely available, and we want people to get a full set of ideas rather than have it being narrowly focused on one aspect, whether it just be biomedical or just be about education. No, it's about as much information toward autism that you can get in one space, because most parents are financially devastated by this disability. And if you can get this information at one conference rather than being forced to attend four or five different conferences around the country, that in and of itself is a huge savings that parents don't have to expend, because the fact is they don't have it to spend.
So when and where is the conference being held?
The conference is being held at the Marriott Hotel O'Hare, which is by O'Hare Airport in Chicago, Illinois. It's being held from May 26th through the 29th. Anybody who wants information from that can go to our website. Again, that's www.autismone.org, or they can contact our founder, Ed Aranga, and his email address and phone number on the website, or they can contact me. Again, my email address and phone number on the website as well. Just click the Contact Us link on our main page, and you'll go right to that information, and we will be more than happy to guide you or answer your questions any way we can.
Great. Okay. Well, that's quite 110 speakers. That's not a small event.
It makes for, right. I mean, we are quickly growing, and we're not the largest autism conference yet, but we are rapidly approaching that. We're expecting an attendance, you know, of nearly 1,000 people this year. And this is considering that this is only our third year in operation. So we've grown to almost double in size as far as the number of parents who are attending. And, you know, and the way we're growing is based on word of mouth. I mean, people are coming to our conferences, and they're coming back the next year, and they're bringing more people with them. And, you know, so, you know, we feel like that by itself, you know, is a feather in our cap, because we haven't done a whole lot to promote the conference other than by word of mouth and by making information available on the web. But, you know, we haven't done any advertising and or press to people or anything. We really, you know, again, we want people to see what we're about and then make a choice for themselves as to whether or not it's worth their time.
Well, this does say something about the need out there if there's that many people that are catching on without you promoting it too much. So
I would
like to thank you for taking the time to come on this program and talk to our listeners. And hopefully if there's anybody in the area that would like to attend the conference, they now know how to get in touch with you, and we'll do so. So please let us know if there are any developments and you want to come back and talk about them, and we'll keep in touch.
Great. Well, I enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Take care.
Have a good night.